From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a weekend review looking at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Ahead on this week's show.
The first recommendation from a task force looking at Common Core educational standards stirs a fight over which assessment test to use.
While a decision is expected soon from the U.S. Supreme Court on same-sex marriage, a judge in Arkansas rules that more than 500 couples who already tied the knot last year should have their marriages recognized.
The federal appeals court tosses out a challenge to upcoming EPA carbon emission standards.
Is openly carrying a firearm legal in Arkansas? There's an effort to get a firm opinion on that.
An official request for a federal disaster declaration is being filed after flooding along the Arkansas and Red Rivers. We'll talk with Sabrina McCormick-Norton from Texarkana station KTXK about the governor's tour of flooding in that area.
For the week ending Friday, June 12, 2015, this is KUAR's Weekend Review. For the past couple of months, Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin has been leading the Governor's Council on Common Core Review. There have been a series of meetings hearing testimony from educators and others with a stake in this. While there are still three more meetings around the state as part of a listening tour, the first recommendation was released this week. And Jacob, it got a pretty heated response.
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre. It's something that you don't really see in committee, the level of animosity it almost felt like between an exchange between Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin and Joyce Elliott, a Democratic state senator from Little Rock, and a little history between those two individuals. They were in committee at the beginning of this week discussing the recommendation from the Common Core Council, which was to end the park test, end the use of the park test, and instead replace that with the ACT or another version of it called the ACT Aspire test. And but those two, they both ran for the same congressional office a few years ago for the 2nd District, which French Hill represents now. Tim Griffin, of course, went on to win, and Joyce Elliott did not. But here's a little bit of an exchange they had.
I'm curious as to whether or not this is strictly a matter of what's convenient for contract purposes or not, or are we going to take seriously what these other people have to say down the road?
Well, first of all, let's be real clear. The governor didn't have to appoint a council. He could have made the decision like that with
well,
or
well, just one second before you, because I just kind of want to, because I know this is time.
If you want me to answer the question,
I do want you to answer the question, but I'm going to ask them, you know, somebody else.
You're going to ask another one?
No, I'm not. I think somebody else, I know he could have made the appointment, but there are questions about authority and so forth. I'm not trying to get at that right
I
now.
I haven't heard those questions. About authority? The governor doesn't have authority?
I'm just saying that's not my question right now. That's
okay.
All.
Okay. Well, I hadn't heard that. So.
Pretty testy.
Right. And Griffin, you know, he really made it clear in that committee meeting at the beginning of this week that the Common Core Council, they have total authority to get this done. Is in his words, he said the governor has the power to make this decision. Well, we'll find out later, I believe, from Sarah that while the council has that recommendation, that wasn't what happened in the end. And someone did reject that recommendation and Griffin and the governor's supposed authority on that. But as to Elliott's actual question, it was about process. And her argument was, how can you come up with a recommendation before the listening tour is done? Because ostensibly, the governor and the Common Core Council are listening to people so they can learn more about what the state needs. But Griffin finally did have an answer for that about 10 minutes later.
If you're asking, would it change our decision on testing if we waited to the 18th? No, I'm sure it wouldn't.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Griffin, I was asking you the question not for us to agree or disagree. I just wanted to get some clarity just so that's clear.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And that is just one recommendation of many the Common Core Council is going to make. So these other listening tours, Griffin would say, we will listen to them for those other recommendations, and this one had to be made because of the purposes of a timeline about when contracts need to be signed about this. But let me just say one more thing about it. Joyce Elliott commented afterward on Facebook about how she felt about that interaction, and she said, quote, "He took a visibly angry exception to my question, was rude and condescending, and there is a display of unchecked arrogance and hostility unmatched by anyone who has ever testified before a committee in my memory." So whether or not it was rude or not, it certainly stuck out in Joyce Elliott's mind that she felt it was. But I spoke with Griffin afterwards, and he said there was nothing improper or anything for anyone to wonder about.
Griffin really did sound like he thought this would be it, that they would make this recommendation, it would be implemented. I know I read a quote, too, from him pretty much saying this is what's going to happen, that the park testing is done. But, Sarah, you covered the Arkansas State Board of Education meeting on Thursday where they voted 7-1 against making this change.
So State Board of Education members had a litany of concern, and there was wide consensus that the process by which the governor came to this decision was not a correct process, that there should have been a call for RFPs, and there should have been a competitive process for determining what company would get the assessment contract, and that the Department of Education specialists on assessment actually weren't directly involved in making this decision or part of the process because of the timing crunch, because the park test has to be renewed every year. And so there's a early July deadline to make a decision if the state's going to continue with park. So park is a test that's aligned with Common Core standards that the state has been implementing for the last few years and implemented the park test for the first time last year. There have been some issues with the rollout, particularly because the park test relies on an internet-based test, and districts have had to apply for waivers to get written versions of the test. But one major complaint about Common Core is the amount of time that teachers and students are spending testing. And the goal of Common Core is to create a national set of standards for literacy and math to be able to compare the achievement of students across states. And so that's one of the reasons that this test was connected to it, this park test, because it was supposed to be a way to assess how students were doing by the same measures everywhere, which currently doesn't exist. And Representative Mark Lowry, Republican from Pulaski County area, was among opponents to this test. He just thinks that it's been a real failure in the state. He's heard a lot of negative feedback about it and said that he actually sponsored a bill earlier in the legislative session to end the use of the park test entirely, which failed in the legislature. But they did pass a law saying that the park test has to be renewed every year. So that's why this deadline exists. And I spoke to Lowry about his response to the state board's decision. And he says, actually, the legislature is going to come back and make it impossible to continue that park contract now.
The legislature is ready to put this back to a situation where ACT Aspire would have to be recognized. The legislative council is ready to disapprove the contract with Park and send us back to the drawing board.
State board members expressed concern that given all of the districts in academic distress in the state, it's quite disruptive to have a change of test every single year, and this would mean 3 years in a row of different tests. So state board member Jay Barth said, how is he supposed to assess the progress of a district in distress when there isn't a consistent testing method?
We knew it was going to be complicated with one transition in assessments. How can a board truly make a decision that is non-arbitrary when there have been that many alterations in assessments?
Department of Education Assistant Commissioner Deborah Jones was there advocating for the change to the ACT, and she says her office has been working, you know, overnight to get this transition prepared to make the contract for the ACT, that the ACT is actually aligned with Common Core standards or is becoming increasingly aligned. And she defended the use of the ACT as a better model for the state.
We have to make a decision and we have to be consistent for a number of years if you do anything. And by a number of years, 7 years, let's get a good quality assessment and let's stick with that for a period of time. As far as setting cut scores and determining school status, that can be done with the assessment. But we have to determine the good assessment that we're going to give and not debate back and forth about it.
So proponents of the ACT say that because so many Arkansas students struggle with college admissions, that using the test and emphasizing it would be a benefit to the state because it would help students all around also being applying to colleges. Dana Breitweiser, a retired Department of Education curriculum specialist, said that fundamentally, you know, she's frustrated that the curriculum specialists at the department weren't really a part of this decision-making process, and so that seems appropriate. So the State Board of Education voted to continue to use the park assessment while considering other options, and now it sounds like Representative Lowry and others who are going to insist on using the ACT and we'll try to bypass that decision through the legislature.
So what happens next?
Well, there's still more recommendations to come, because we have to keep in mind, while this park test is one component, very important component, something that teachers and parents and students definitely look at, because there's a big argument there's too much teaching to the test in the schools. But it's interesting that they came out with this before a recommendation on whether or not to keep Common Core at all. So it seems if you're going to suggest we want a replacement test that is aligned to Common Core standards, which the council argues the ACT is, that would seem to suggest, well, maybe they're going to keep Common Core if they want to have a new test for Common Core. We don't know that yet, of course. But Griffin made a big point during his entire presentation, not just on the park test, but in other areas like the ways they teach math or the way they teach literature, that a lot of people's frustrations, although they're real and they're valid frustrations, that they're actually something that's associated with Common Core and not necessarily something that's required. And so that's kind of interesting to me that through doing that, Griffin was kind of defending Common Core in a way by saying a lot of people's frustrations aren't Common Core per se, but some of the voluntary aspects that schools maybe should have chosen a better way to implement Common Core.
Throughout the Common Core hearings, I only heard Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin say generally positive things about Common Core standards, and it seems that he is opposed to the use of the park test. So it is interesting that they're issuing this recommendation before finishing the public comment period, but it seems like there's a consensus in favor of Common Core.
But end of June is when Griffin said we should know everything from that council that's going to come out and forms a recommendation from the governor's office.
And Griffin was appointed by the governor. He specifically asked him to lead this look at Common Core. What has the governor said this week?
Well, the governor sent out a press release basically saying, while he respects everyone on the State Board of Education, it was a 7-1 vote, but he thinks they made the wrong choice, and he still continues to believe that ACT is the best choice, but we'll see whether or not he gets behind Representative Lowry's effort.
All right. Well, another big story this week. Floodwaters are finally receding along the Arkansas and Red Rivers. Here in the Little Rock area, it hasn't been too bad. We've had parks that have had flooding. The river trail has been closed in spots. Especially impacted by the Arkansas River, though, has been Pine Bluff, where you've had a few hundred homes that have been flooded. The floodwaters are finally starting to recede there, and people are returning to their homes and beginning the cleanup process. Also down in southwest Arkansas, flooding from the Red River has impacted farmers, as well as one community right along the river there. On Tuesday, Governor Asa Hutchinson visited that area. He also toured it by helicopter, getting a firsthand look at the flooding. Sabrina McCormick-Norton is news director of NPR station KTXK in Texarkana, a partner of ours. She was there for the governor's visit and joins me now to discuss that. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Well, we certainly have seen our fair share of flooding here in the Arklatex, and specifically, you know, Texarkana is a bi-state area, so we've actually had more flooding on the Bowie County side of the state line rather than the Miller County side of the state line. But, you know, you can see the impact and smell the impact in many places. Certainly in Bowie County, they don't even estimate how many thousands of acres were flooded. And in Miller County, while the impact was not quite so dramatic, it has still managed to close several roads and cause some problems, especially with travel. I mean, as you know, Index Bridge is still closed today and likely will remain so for the next few days. Anybody who works in Ashdown from Texarkana has a nice hour-long commute if they go the long way. So lots of things have happened or have been affected because of these floods.
And in particular, Garland City, what has been the impact there? Describe what the people you've spoken with have experienced in that town of a few hundred people.
Well, you know, in Garland City, I think it was, late Thursday night of last week, they experienced some problems with the levees there. That day, they asked people to leave. There was an evacuation order, so those people were forced to leave their homes and travel to Texarkana. The Red Cross did open a shelter to incorporate those folks, but it was a scary situation. And even though they managed to contain it, it was, I think, a small leak underneath one of the levees. It took all night to do so. So there's a lot of volunteer work involved, lots of man hours, and they managed to quell the leak, and those people were invited back to their homes. Now, as far as major damage in Garland City, Arkansas, I don't believe there was any. I think if you look further north, maybe close to Little River County, you saw a bigger impact there.
And the governor spoke there at the foot of the U.S. Highway 82 bridge that had been closed. You were there. First, tell me a little about what the governor had to say.
Well, that specific area, that spot, is the home of two businesses, first off. The West Shores Restaurant, and I think there's a K&A liquor store, a small convenience store right there, too, and both of which are mostly submerged underwater, at least at the point he got there. So looking at those two businesses and the smell alone from that stagnant standing water, you know, it really did create quite a scene. And he came and he spoke very briefly.
Well, why don't we listen to a little bit of what the governor had to say?
Sure.
You know, being able to fly over the flood area is about as eye-opening as you can imagine. It's much more informative, really, than even being on the ground. And so I wanted to come down here for two reasons. One, to do a personal assessment of the flood damage, because we're going to, as the judge pointed out, he's been so busy just simply responding and protecting property that you really haven't had an opportunity to do an extensive assessment on the damage to crops, to livestock, and to property. And obviously there's been lives that have been lost as well. That is the worst tragedy. But we've got to do an assessment of damages, and that will be ongoing in the coming months. I have David Maxwell, our head of ADEM, Arkansas Department of Emergency Management, here as well, and he was with me as we surveyed the damage. But secondly, I was very interested in the levees. And obviously here in Garland City, there was concern about the breach of the levee that caused the evacuation of the citizens here. And I was being briefed constantly on the levee situation as governor. But it reminds me, because it's not just here, it's in Perry County. We have some erosion of our levees, and we need to increase our inspection of our levees, our non-flood time work on our levee system. And I know we have some legislative leaders going to be holding hearings on that, but those two purposes are very important. And then obviously I want to thank the local volunteers and leadership, the judge, the emergency management folks, the citizens of this area that's done an extraordinary job in responding to the cries of neighbors, the concerns about protecting property, whether it's moving cattle or whether it is sandbagging. And that's something that only local citizens can do, and they did an extraordinary job, and my hats are off to them.
So the governor said Tuesday that he is preparing to ask for a federal disaster declaration for 37 Arkansas counties that have been impacted. And as you said, the flooding has been more extreme in Bowie County on the Texas side down there. And he kind of alluded to the fact that Texas and Oklahoma have really been getting the national attention on this, but doesn't want Arkansas to be overlooked.
That's true. Actually, he did say that he wanted Arkansas's voice to be heard, because Southwest Arkansas had certainly suffered a lot of damage because of the floods also. You know, he did say that he wrote a letter to the nation's U.S. Agriculture Secretary to ask for farmers here in the region to be able to receive emergency loans because of crop damage. I know that especially in Little River County, they've experienced quite a bit of crop damage. I think Mike Cranford, the county judge there, said maybe as much as 50% of their row crops were underwater. Not to mention cattle ranchers affected by the floods didn't get a chance to cut their hay because the grass that they normally would have cut was inundated with floodwaters and rainwaters even before that, causing problems. So there's a lot to consider, and he was very sympathetic to the people dealing with the flood here in this area.
Any estimate of when the floodwaters will completely recede? I know the state officials have said that because of the extremely hot, dry weather we've had this week, that that's actually lowered the water more quickly than had been expected. But any estimate when waters will be completely down and out of the businesses and fields?
You know, I've asked, and they still give me, you know, maybe several days, another week or 2 weeks. Last estimate when I was covering last week, these floods, was as, you know, as late as July. So there's really no telling. And actually, everybody's in a waiting game because they can't determine the damage unless they see it. So there's still a lot left. And people are still trying to figure out just exactly what they're going to do and how badly they've been affected.
And you've mentioned two times the smell. Can you describe what does this standing floodwater smell like?
Well, especially the area that I've seen, you know, in rolling water, you don't maybe have that stagnant smell, but there is definitely the smell. It smells like, I don't know, shrimp that have been left out for maybe a few hours. It's really, and it is just really overwhelming. In fact, after that assignment that morning, I smelled like it for the rest of the day. So it was very unpleasant. And I'm sure it's very unpleasant for the residents living near those areas.
Right. You have to feel for those people, yeah, trying to deal with that.
And they did say, and this specifically is the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management. He was there, I think he was the director. Said that they hope to finish preliminary surveys this week and hopes to have the governor's request for assistance sent to the president in a couple of weeks. And that's both for individual and for public assistance.
Okay, and of course, this all was the result of the extremely heavy rains that fell in a very short period of time, especially in Oklahoma. And that, of course, flows from on the Arkansas River. It flows south and, of course, on the Red River as well. And the heavy rain is what prompted all this flooding here in Arkansas, areas that didn't really get especially heavy rain here, but this was the residual effects from that.
Yes, that is correct. And you stated this in the rainwaters that fell for the last several days when the floods really started to creep up on those living here.
Well, that's Sabrina McCormick Norton, news director of KTXK in Texarkana, who has been out assessing the flood damage and also accompanied the governor during his tour of the area on Tuesday. Sabrina, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Well, another story this week, a judge ordered Arkansas officials to recognize more than 500 same-sex marriages that were conducted over a one-week period last year at three counties around the state. Here's how one of those weddings sounded.
We're gathered together in the presence of God, family, and friends to witness and celebrate the joining of James and Chris in holy marriage. The bond of marriage was established in creation. The Creator.
And interestingly, that's Judge Wendell Griffin leading that particular ceremony. He was among those who came out to the Pulaski County Courthouse. You had a big line of people. I was out there, I believe it was May 12th of last year, when you had people lined up before dawn to be among those who got the chance to get married in Little Rock. Eureka Springs had the first marriages occur 2 days before that on a Saturday. But there was question as to whether or not these marriages are legal. The case was brought by two couples who were wed, but then denied the ability to jointly file their tax returns. One of the couples also objected that one person couldn't sign up for their spouse's health insurance policy. And Judge Griffin essentially said that these marriages are valid and the state has to recognize them. This really came down to whether or not the judge who tossed out the state's amendment that defined marriage as being between one man and one woman had the power to issue a revised opinion the following week that clarified this, his order, and said that these cases should be allowed to stand. This comes while the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to make a ruling by the end of the month about same-sex marriage. The case from Arkansas, which is before the Arkansas Supreme Court, has not been decided. The Arkansas Supreme Court heard this in November, but did not issue an opinion. And here we are now, 7 months later, still no opinion. So it seems that there's really just a waiting game here to see what the U.S. Supreme Court has to say.
As you mentioned, you played at the beginning of bringing this topic up, Judge Wendell Griffin was a minister for some of these weddings. I imagine that affected the way a lot of people viewed his decision-making ability.
Yeah, and surprisingly, we didn't hear more about that aspect of this. Attorney General Leslie Rutledge did issue a press release and said that she disagreed with this. And we'll see where this actually goes from here. Well, Chris, this week, a federal appeals court threw out a lawsuit from several states, including Arkansas, that challenged a proposed rule by the Environmental Protection Agency, which seeks to reduce carbon emissions at power plants across the country. The court ruled against the state primarily because of a timing issue, but carbon emissions, the rule still would have major implications here.
Yeah, that's right. The Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., a three-judge panel, essentially ruled that the about dozen states, including Arkansas, who challenged the EPA's new rule that under the proposal would establish a reduction target of 30% for carbon emissions from power plants around the country by the year 2030. The court ruled that since the rule has not been finalized yet by the EPA, that there's no existing legal precedent by which the states could have challenged the law. However, Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge has said that she would still likely pursue further challenges once the law is finalized. Although in the immediate aftermath of this, the Arkansas Sierra Club's Glenn Hooks commented on the lack of legal precedent.
You can't sue to overturn a rule that hasn't been finalized. So our attorney general and others really wasted a lot of taxpayer resources trying to overturn a rule that hasn't been finalized yet. So we didn't think that the ruling would go any other way, and we were happy to see that it came down the way we thought it would.
As you can hear there, Glenn Hooks's claim, as well as others who tend to be proponents of the proposed rule by the EPA, say that the state is wasting taxpayers' money in order to challenge this law that has not become final. Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge responded to this accusation.
We intervened on the lawsuit, which had already been started by a number of other states, including Alabama, Alaska, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Nebraska, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Dakota, West Virginia, and Wyoming. And so Arkansas's intervention was minimal cost. And we had in-house counsel that drafted that motion to intervene.
And this week, Governor Asa Hutchinson said he supports other avenues to challenge this new EPA rule.
And Arkansas is very heavily dependent upon coal, even more so than other states.
Right. And like I said, the national target for emissions reduction is about 30% by the year 2030. However, there is a state-by-state emissions reduction target. In Arkansas, that's going to be about 44% by the year 2030. However, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, a little more than half of the state's electricity came from coal power, about 53%. And according to the ADEQ, Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, and the Arkansas Public Service Commission, about 86% of carbon emissions, which amount to about 40 million metric tons in 2013, came from coal power here in the state. Now, given Arkansas's high target for emissions reductions set by the EPA under this proposed rule, it leaves Arkansas in a difficult spot, mainly because of its high reliance on coal power. There are five coal plants in the state. Three are more than 30 years old. Two were built in the last 10 years. And the ADEQ and the Public Service Commission have noted that there's been a large increase in CO2 emissions in the state since 2005. It's been a 39% emissions increase. One of the guiding points from the EPA's proposed rule is that this emissions reduction target is based on 2005 levels. So the state has had a larger increase in the amount of emissions since 2005. So it's likely that we'll have sort of a steeper hill to climb in terms of reducing emissions by that date in the future. Since the state is so reliant on coal, and a lot of utility companies have pointed this out, it'll be very costly for the state or for utility companies to meet the emissions reductions targets.
And utility companies say that will trickle down to the customers.
To the customers, yeah. For instance, the Arkansas Electric Cooperatives say that it may end up being a 20 to 40% increase in utility rates for their customers. They serve about 500,000 customers in the state. I spoke with Sandra Bird. She's the Vice President for Public Affairs at the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Here she's commenting just on what they see are the implications of the rule as it is proposed.
The implications are incredibly serious. For one, we would not have a reliable grid if the rule as proposed went into effect and became the final rule. There would be potential disruptions of electric service all over the country, cascading outages, rolling brownouts or blackouts. So the ability for us to provide reliable electric service to our members would be a mission that we could not achieve.
So there you can get a sense of many of the utility companies' views on this. The purpose of this rule is really to reduce carbon emissions that affect global warming. And that was the EPA's goal and the Obama administration in promoting this new rule that's going to be finalized, many observers believe, in August. A lot of proponents of reducing carbon emissions point out, you know, that in addition to the carbon emissions that affect the global climate, on a local level, I mean, there's a emission of nitrogen oxides, sulfur dioxides, particulate matter that can cause respiratory illness for people living near coal plants. And even, you know, I think it was last year, the state health department issued an advisory finding high levels of mercury in the lakes. It's about a dozen lakes of, you know, around Arkansas. Many people think that's in part due to an increased reliance on coal production and emissions from coal plants in the state. Like I said, there are two power plants built, the Turk power plant in southwest Arkansas and Plum Point in northeast, that had an effect on this in increasing emissions.
Is there going to be an appeal by the state? Is there another step the state will take to challenge this?
That all depends on what the final form of the rule looks like. And of course, you know, Arkansas is in a pool of about a dozen other states challenging the rule as it stands now.
I just want to add a few things that you're talking about. One particular electric provider said this would be devastating nationally. A few months ago, I went to a groundbreaking for MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators, which is one of Arkansas's two major power grids. They control some power that goes to a few other states. And they said, well, you know, we're worried about the cost of this, but they said, oh, we'll be fully prepared and we don't expect, you know, we were not trying to scare our customers. They think it might go up, but they think, you know, they say they're a good business and they'll be able to handle it. So it's not uniform maybe within the industry.
That's true. But we should note that MISO is kind of handles the energy distribution. One thing that Electric Cooperatives points out is that in addition to the final goal under the proposed rule of emissions target by 2030, there's actually an interim goal to be reached by 2020. And for Arkansas, the state reduction emissions reduction target by 2020 is about 41%. And the final goal is like 44% by 2030. So they argue that, well, in 4 or 5 years after the rule is finalized, you know, they won't be able to adequately replace their sources of energy in a timely manner to meet the rule. And it might cause the closing of some of their coal assets.
And one final item this week, we had a request for an official opinion from Attorney General Leslie Rutledge regarding the open carrying of weapons in Arkansas. There's been a lot of confusion among different police agencies in the state regarding whether or not it is legal to carry a handgun openly or any other kind of weapon. And Jacob, this really all started during the 2013 legislative session. A bill was passed that some say makes open carry legal in Arkansas, while others, some lawmakers say they voted for this bill, not knowing that that was the case.
Right. And 2013, when the law came out, we had a different attorney general than we have now. We had a Democrat, Dustin McDaniel, and he said pretty vigorously that this does not allow open carry. It is illegal to openly carry your firearms. But since then, we've had a number of different interpretations. It seems like now that most county sheriffs say you can legally openly carry firearms. Someone brought a handgun into a movie theater in West Little Rock at the beginning of this week, and the police allowed that man to stay in the movie theater, watch the movie. So that's Little Rock Opinions Police on it. But I was eavesdropping in the hallway of the Capitol at a Capitol Committee meeting. I heard Nate Bell talking with some suited men of some import about about open carry and what they might do about it. So I asked, I didn't linger too long. I lingered a polite amount of time, and afterwards I went up to him and I said, you know, I overheard part of your conversation, and I figured it might have something to do with trying to clear up open carry. And he told me that he, along with Senator John Woods and another representative, have asked for an official opinion from the Attorney General. This is a non-binding opinion, but their hope is for these law enforcement agencies that are holding out, maybe holding on to McDaniel's advisory opinion, that Leslie Rutledge might come down on their side, since she has said before to journalists that she believes open carry is legal. So Nate Bell, tell me a little bit about why he decided to act.
A lot of law enforcement agencies are being asked to make decisions. There's a lot of public pressure for the process to speed up. And so several of us just felt like it was best that we go ahead and get an opinion request out there, even though they're not legally binding. And they do offer some guidance to some of the law enforcement community who a few of them seem to be confused.
And the Attorney General has been very clear that she believes that open carry is legal, but they want an official opinion. What's the difference?
It's kind of interesting. So I guess before she just said offhand or to reporters or at campaign stops, which means nothing other than it's her opinion. And this advisory opinion that would come out of her office, it's still non-binding. Nobody has to follow it. But for instance, I talked to this state police spokesman sometime last week, and he said, well, you know, we don't want to make our own officers necessarily have to make that call for themselves. And so they go by the guidance that was issued by Dustin McDaniel. So maybe that would help for some agencies like state police, something that they would listen to, although they don't necessarily have to. You know, last week, one senator who signed this, John Woods, told me, I'm going to submit the attorney general opinion. And then he didn't for a few days. And I thought, well, what happened? But he joined in on this letter. And Nate Bell said that they deliberately held off for a little while, but they felt the pressure was just too much. And another thing in 2015, people wonder why they didn't clarify the law just a few months ago. They had an opportunity to clarify the law in the legislature, and John Woods told me they didn't think they had the votes to do it. So it's interesting how we got to open carry, if we are there.
And certainly it is a concern when different agencies are interpreting the law differently. So state police essentially believe it is illegal for someone to openly carry a weapon?
That's what a state police spokesman told me, is that they go by the last attorney general opinion, which says you can't just carry a firearm around. They believe that this 2013 law was just about clarifying travel between counties so that you could keep it with you without any kind of technical problems.
And that was what some believed that this bill essentially did, was just if you're moving or...
Yeah, after 2013, after the session closed, there's a few groups, one called Arkansas Carry, that started marching throughout towns, Jonesboro, Fort Smith, even in Little Rock in the River Market, with handguns on their hips, openly displayed, no concealed carry license or anything like that required. So that's kind of interesting that you don't need any kind of license to openly carry, but concealed carry, you do have to have some degree of license and training.
Well, we'll wrap it up with that. You've been listening to KUAR's Week in Review. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
We welcome your feedback. Send any comments, corrections, or concerns to news@kuar.org. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme music is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.